are listening to a message from Stonegate Church. For more information about Stonegate and additional audio resources, please visit stonegate.church.
Good morning, Stonegate. So I just finished reading a book. If you are working on your reading list for 2026, you should totally put it's not a Christian book. But the book is called The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. Splendid and the Vile. And it tells the story of life in London during the German bombing campaign of World War II. And let me just say, wow. I mean, what a time to be alive. I mean, this was a crazy time to be alive. And I actually think today, as we're getting ready for 2026, it might be helpful for us to try to imagine what life might have been like back in those days. So if you will, just get into the DeLorean with me, Back to the Future style, just for a moment. And we're going to travel back to London during the Blitz in late 1940. Okay, so we get in our DeLorean. We're now in 1940, and we're laying in bed, and you hear the buzz of German bombers over your head. Night after night, German bombers fill the sky. Buildings collapse. Families are separated. Loved ones die, and no one knows whether or not you're even going to be a country in the next year, because the Nazis might come crashing down your door and taking over everything you know and love. You don't even know if you're going to survive the Nazi invasion. And because the bombings come at night, people go to bed knowing that there's a real possibility they might not wake up in the next morning. Like they might actually get blown to smithereens while they're asleep. Now, try to put yourself in that bed. You're laying there, you're hearing the buzzing of the bombs, you're hearing the whistle of bombs as they're falling through the air, and then you feel the earth-shattering shake of a bomb hitting the building next to you. Like, that's a crazy time. How would you respond in a moment like that? I think for me, sleep would have been a very real issue, right? Like, sleep is probably not happening at a moment like that. Like, who could lie down peacefully with that kind of danger literally looming over your head? And yet, under the leadership of guys like Winston Churchill, the people of Britain were urged to carry on with life like nothing was happening, just another ordinary day. They went to work. They still went to work. No sick days, right? You're just going to work. You celebrate birthdays. You read books. And remarkably, you slept. Slept. How? For Londoners during the Blitz, sleep wasn't just a biological need. It was an act of resistance. That's what sleep meant for them. They slept not because there was no danger. They slept because they refused to let the enemy into the bedroom. They would not let the Nazis had taken the skies, but they would not take their beds. So going to bed became a quiet form of defiance. And by lying down, they were taking a stand. That's what they were saying. When they went to bed every night, they refused to let Nazi invasion dictate their anxiety, their fear, and to steal their sleep. Now, I tell that story because I don't know how I would live in a world like that. Like going to bed, putting my kids to bed. I'm a father of four. Like I imagine I'm probably an insomniac around these days, right? It's like I grew up in Oklahoma where in the summer times, like tornadoes could come in the middle of the night and you just kind of did your thing. Well, this is like the Blitz, like bombs are falling. How do you sleep in these days? How do you sleep at night knowing that bombs could fall into your whole family? It's crazy. I tell that story because we might not be having bombs fall on our heads right now at the moment, but we do live in a very anxious world, don't we? We can sympathize with the anxiety that the Londoners were feeling as they were experiencing life in the Blitz. I mean, just glance at the headlines for a moment. It's like, who can sleep in a world like this? Like, this is an anxious world. Who is just dozing off and relaxing and able to close their eyes and sleep in a crazy world like what we have? But here's what we're going to find out this morning. What we do when our world is falling apart says something about us. What we do when our world is falling apart says something about us. Even more specifically, how we sleep when the sky feels like it's falling, says something about our faith. Now, I'm your theological director, and they hired me to give sermons like this to tell you that your naps are theological. If you didn't know that, just get on board with the train. Your naps are theological. And we're going to take a deep dive on the theology of naps this morning. And some of you might be going, really? We're going to sit through a sermon about sleeping? Look, I've kept careful track. I've kept careful notes. We have yet to have a sermon this year on sleeping. So before the year gets out, you're going to learn what the Bible has to say about sleep. Okay? So that's what we're doing. Your naps are theological. For the British, going to bed during the Blitz was a form of defiance against the enemy. But for us Christians, going to bed displays confidence in God. It's more than defiance. We are displaying confidence in our God. And as we'll see in Psalm 3, David lies down and he sleeps while his world is falling apart. Why? Not because he's depressed, not because he's in denial, but because he has faith. That's why he sleeps. He goes to bed. He takes a nap when the sky is falling, because he trusts God. Now that should say something to you. We're not in David's world. We don't live in David's time. We don't have the same issues that David had. But we, like David, live in an anxious age. And for, I'm guessing, many of us in the room, sleep is a real problem. And one of the reasons sleep is a real problem is we're anxious and worried. We don't get sleep because we're worried. And with this being the last Sunday of the year and us looking down the barrel of 2026 with all the fresh uncertainties, the anxieties, the worries, all the things that might come in this next year, it seems like a fitting moment just to resubmit to you the question, what are you really trusting in? What does your sleep say about you and your faith in God? Psalm 3 says something shocking. When your world falls apart, faith can look like sleep. When your world is falling apart, you can sleep knowing that God is absolutely sovereign over it all, absolutely in control and keeping his promises. You can sleep because God is sovereign. For Christians, God's sovereignty lulls us to sleep. It allows us to close our eyes because we believe when we close our eyes, our God still reigns. So, that's where we're going today. If you look closely at your Bibles in Psalm 3, you'll see this little italicized line that a lot of us ignore. But in Psalm 3, you get everything you need to know about the context. When David writes these words, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. Now, some of you might not know what that means or what historical context it is, but it might as well say the day David's world fell apart. This is when the psalm was written. The day David's world fell apart. It is literally the worst days of David's life. And that's including all the days that David lived on the run, lived in caves, hid from Saul, was the most wanted man in all of Israel, including all of those days. This is the worst days of David's life, the worst days. And he writes this psalm. If you want to know more about what's actually going on behind the scenes of Psalm 3, you have to read 2 Samuel chapters 15 through 17, which gives you a very detailed account of all the things that David was going through. Now, I just, when I went back and I read 2 Samuel 15 through 17, it dawned on me, it's not describing a bad day for David. It's not just a bad day for David. It is the collapse of everything David knows and loves. It is the collapse of everything about David's life. Let me just give you a few of the highlights of David's bad day. David's own son Absalom betrays his father, orchestrates a conspiracy against him, publicly undermines his father's credibility as king, and turns a private family dysfunction into a national crisis. One bad Thanksgiving family meal now becomes public headlines, and we're at civil war. That's essentially what happened. Everything private goes wide open, and it leads to war. Then Absalom, in his cocky confidence, marches into Jerusalem with David's closest friends, allies, and advisors marching behind him. All of them just basically saying, we have a vote of no confidence in David. We think his son would do it better. So they march into Jerusalem, and David effectively loses the throne. He loses his job. And because he worked from home, he lost his house. So, hated, family dysfunction made a public national crisis, fired, and homeless. And that's not where it ends. One final act of humiliation, I'm not going to go into details here, we'll keep it PG, you can read it for yourself, but Absalom publicly disgraces David's entire household in front of all of Jerusalem. And then to top it all off, if you wanted to poll the majority of the people what they thought about David, as Psalm 3 tells us, the majority of people believe that David's toast. They're saying things like, there is no salvation for him in God. They're saying things like, God has abandoned David. God has cursed David. God is against David. God is done with David, and he's as good as dead. That's what they're saying about him. That's his bad day. Now, for some of you, you've experienced aspects of that. Some of you are currently living David's bad day. I mean, you think about it, family dysfunction, national crisis, betrayal from friends, job loss, potential homelessness, financial fears, public humiliation, and some of you, the strong possibility of death in 2026. Those are the things you're facing. For some of you, you're reading about David's newsreel, and it's just the highlight of your life, of what you're going through. I know there are people in this room right now that right now, it feels like the world is falling apart. And when you look ahead to 2026, you're afraid it's just going to get worse. The crumble has already begun, and it's continuing to crack. The ice is falling through. The finances are getting tighter. The health is going down. The tumor's growing. All these things are happening. The news headlines are getting more fearful. You're looking at it, it's like it's getting worse. And David will look at you right in the eye, and he would say, I get it. I've been there. I get it. David's bad day is not all that unique. We're experiencing moments of it. We know kind of what it's like to have a family member turn on us. We know what it's like to lose our job. We know what it's like to lose our home. We know what it's like to face death. We know those things. But what makes David unique is what he did in light of his bad day. That's what makes him unique. 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 14, gives us a little more detail than Psalm 3 does, and it says that when David fled Jerusalem, he was tired, and he makes it to the Jordan River. And then it says he refreshed himself. I looked up that word, refreshed himself. It can mean a lot of different things. It could mean he took a breath. It could mean he chillaxed. It could mean a lot of different things. But Psalm 3 makes it explicit what he did. Here's what he did. I lay down and slept. He took a nap in the middle of war. What an idiot. Who does that? What an odd move for a guy who just lost his job. What an odd move for a guy who lost his home. What an odd move for a guy who has few friends and his family's against him, and there are people trying to kill him. The Jordan River is not that far from Jerusalem, David. This doesn't seem like the appropriate place to take a nap. You're taking it a bit too far here. This is taking the phrase, he can sleep through anything, way too far. Who could possibly sleep under those kinds of conditions? Now, I've been in anxious moments before. I've been afraid for my job before. I've been afraid about finances before. We've had kids, and so that means we're afraid every time the flu season comes around. Like, we're anxious people as parents. And when I get anxious, I can barely sit. My wife calls me a pacer, not because I set the pace, because I pace, because I'm anxious. I can barely sit still, let alone lie down and take a nap when I'm anxious. Who does that? David does. But why? Why does David sleep when he's in his most anxious moment of life? He doesn't sleep because he needs to. Let's just be clear about that. He doesn't sleep because he needs to. Yes, it's true, it's tired. Yes, he's tired. Yes, it's true that he needs a little bit of refreshment that a nap can give. That's all true, but that is not why he sleeps. He sleeps because he knows something few others do. God is sovereign, which means God is in control, and he will keep his promises. I want you to think about David's nap as an embodied statement of faith. When David naps, it's like, hey, I'm napping so I can show you what I believe. When you see this tired, sleepy king lie down and close your eyes, you're met with the reality. David's not the true king. God is. David sleeps because God doesn't. David sleeps because God reigns. David lays his head down because God is in control. That's why he does it. And so he naps right there on the battlefield. I just imagine everybody sharpening their swords, putting spearheads on shafts, and look over and you see David and you're like, the dude's straight up snoring. How can he do that? It's so easy to read Psalm 3. I remember I used to read Psalm 3 all the time. I'd read the Psalms once a year, and I'd try to get through all the Psalms, and I'd pass over the Psalm 3 and be like, yeah, he slept, blah, 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 blah. And then I remember one time, I go, wait a second. He slept during this one. It's a big deal. And I put myself in David's shoes, and I'm like, I can't imagine what I'd do if my son tried to murder me and take my job. And yet David sleeps, and how is he able to sleep? Why is he able to sleep? He sleeps because of three anchors that hold him steady. There are three anchors that allows David to sleep. The first one is this. He knows who God is. The second one is he knows what God can do. And the third one is he knows whose voice defines reality. He knows who God is. He knows what God can do. And he knows whose voice defines reality. The first anchor that holds David steady is that first point. David knows who God is, and he knows who God is to him. It's not mere abstract theology, right? It's not just saying things about God. It's personal knowledge forged through experience and through dependence. There's a big difference about knowing things about God and actually knowing God. You can say all you want, God is omnipresent, that he's everywhere, but it's not until you say, God is everywhere I go, that you begin to experience how omnipresence is reality. Like, this is just knowledge about God. This is knowledge of God. I know God is everywhere. That's knowledge about God. I know God is everywhere with me. That's experiential knowledge. And if you're going to survive in this world of anxiety, it's only the second knowledge that can hold you firm. Knowledge about God will do nothing for you to keep you steady and lull you to sleep. Knowing God will. Here's how David puts it. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. Do you hear what David's doing there? He's not just confessing general things about God. He confesses truths about God and then applies who God is to what he's facing. He's in danger. His life is on the line. So what? God is my shield. Not a shield, my shield. He's been disgraced and publicly humiliated. God is my glory. He's running away. He's going through all the shame and the guilt and all the things. All this has happened because of his sin with Bathsheba. There's guilt. There's all these skeletons in his closet. He knows all these things that are enough to lower his head in absolute shame, absolute embarrassment. And yet he says, God is the lifter of my head, personally, my head. And when I'm alone, I cry and he answers me. David knows who God is and who God is in that situation. He's not just the Lord God. He is the Lord my God. And that little personal pronoun makes all the difference to give you confidence to sleep. Some of you can't sleep because he is the Lord God, and you need to remember, he is the Lord your God. He's not just a father, he is your father. He's not just Lord, he is your Lord. He's not just a rock, he's your rock. He's not just a fortress, he's your fortress. He is the Lord your God, and you can have confidence in him. That's the first anchor we need to go to sleep at night, knowing who God is to me personally. He is my father. And then there's the second anchor. David not only knows who God is, he knows what God can do. He knows what God can do. Listen to all the actions he asked God to do. Arise, O Lord. This is verse 7. Arise, O Lord. Save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek and you break the teeth of the wicked. David knows that the deck is not stacked against him because of who's on his side. God is completely capable of saving him. Absalom taking over the throne, the army of Jerusalem following after his son, none of that changes the game. God can do what he pleases. God is in power. God can strike the enemies on the cheek. They're trying to humiliate David. God can turn it back on them. He uses this kicking the teeth in of the wicked. Imagine someone having so much power, they're able to grab a snake and defang it in front of you. The snake can hiss, the snake can strike, but it can't bite because the one who defanged it made it harmless, and that's what God can do. God can defang snakes. God can kick out the teeth of lions, and God can make harmful situations harmless because he's God. David knows what God can do, and he knows that God is not against him. He knows that God is for him, and therefore God will intercede for him. Now, there's one final anchor that gives David the confidence to nap. David has confidence to nap because David knows that God's voice defines reality. God's voice defines reality. Now, let me just say, I'm no expert when it comes to anxiety. I'm not a psychoanalyst. I'm not a counselor. I'm not any of that. So I can't claim to know how anxiety works. I also know it's really important not to lessen or diminish how it works. Anxiety is a real complex thing. It's a real thing. However, I think it's safe to say that anxiety is more than fear. We agreed on that? Anxiety is more than fear. In reality, anxiety is a competing interpretation of reality. That's what anxiety is. It's a competing interpretation of reality. What's really going on? Who's in charge of the situation? Whose power really matters? What's the most real thing to me at this moment? All those things are what make anxiety. Anxiety grows best when the cancer diagnosis is given the final word. I'm terminal. There's the reality. Or when the boss seems to hold ultimate power over the future. If he fires me, I'll never have a future. Or when people's opinions rule the day. What they think of me must be true. Anxiety grows in that kind of soil when you let the voices of everybody else around you, when you let the voice of your situation dictate what reality is. And David refuses to go there because Absalom does not dictate what's real. Neither do the advisors, neither do the armies, neither does the situation, neither does the homelessness, neither does the job loss. None of it dictates reality. One of my favorite people, C.S. Lewis, again, if you've not read any C.S. Lewis books, it should be at the top of your list of 2026. Start with the Chronicles of Narnia, easiest first. Work your way up, save the space trilogy, or skip it. You're fine. Okay. A lot of people don't know about C.S. Lewis and about his life. We just know he wrote those stories, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, that you read maybe an excerpt from in elementary school. But C.S. Lewis lived through some of the most harrowing moments of the 20th century. A lot of people don't know that C.S. Lewis was a second lieutenant in World War I, for example. He fought in the trenches of World War I. And how he got out of the war was a shell went off and killed one of his best buddies. And when that shell exploded and killed one of his best buddies, the shrapnel came and got him, and he got injured in World War I and got sent home. Then, after being wounded in World War I, he witnesses the rise of Hitler. He witnesses Hitler take over Poland. He witnesses the Battle of Britain. He witnesses the Blitzkrieg. He witnesses all these things, and he lives long enough to witness the dawn of the age of the atomic bomb. And now in 1948, C.S. Lewis is living in this world where all eyes are to the skies because everybody is afraid there's going to be a bomb that's going to completely wipe out society. There's rumors that the Nazis have been developing this bomb that could destroy London completely, which was true. People were trying to develop that at that moment. So somebody asked C.S. Lewis, like, how can you go about like this is all normal? Like this is average life. Here's what C.S. Lewis said. In 1948, atomic bombs, like people are just, I mean, if you just can imagine, go back to the 1960s commercials and cartoons of the atomic age, it's like everything gets destroyed. I watched some kind of Santa commercial where an atomic bomb hit Santa's sleigh and it destroyed everything. Like it was like this fear of what the atomic bomb could do was governing everything. Like everybody was thinking they were going to die from an atomic bomb. And here's what C.S. Lewis says. We think a great deal too much of the atomic bomb. It's perfectly ridiculous to go about whimpering and drawing long faces because the scientists have added one more chance of painful and premature death to a world which already bristled with such chances and in which death itself is not a chance at all, but a certainty. If we are all going to be destroyed by an atomic bomb, let the bomb, when it comes, find us doing sensible human things, praying, working, teaching, reading, listening to music, bathing the children, playing tennis, chatting to our friends over a pint and a game of darts, not huddled together like frightened sheep and thinking about bombs. Somebody later pressed him and they said, okay, Lewis, that great little speech. I want you to imagine that you hear the whistling of a bomb overhead and you look up and sure enough, it's an atomic bomb. You're going to die. What's your last thought? C.S. Lewis cleared his throat and he looked back at the interviewer and he said, I'd look up at the bomb and I'd stick out my tongue and I'd say, poo. And then he said, I'd speak to the bomb and I'd say, you're just a bomb. I'm an immortal soul. Can you imagine having that? He's not being brave. He's not showing bravado. He's not showing false confidence. He's just doing what David did. Atomic bombs don't define reality. God does. God is the one who's called you eternal. God is the one who's bought you eternal life. Atomic bombs can't hit that deep. God defines reality. Not the economy, not your health, not your family, not your friends, not your fears. None of those things define reality. God does. And it's when you let God's voice have the loudest volume and to determine what is real that you can sleep really good. So there's your three anchors. Know who God is. Know what God can do, and let God's promises dictate reality. Take three of those, go to sleep, and call me in the morning. That's how you get a good night's sleep. Those three. Anchor yourself to those three things. Who is God? What can he do? And why in the heck am I letting other things determine what's true? And then go to sleep. Now, David took a big risk lying down for a nap. I'm a what if kind of guy, right? I'm always asking what if. You know, what if I fall asleep and this happens? What if I fall asleep and my liver goes out? What if I fall asleep and my heart stops? You know, a number of things. I'm a what if kind of guy. David had his own kind of what ifs here, right? So he's sleeping by the Jordan, taking a nap. And what if one of his guards turned on him? Like, what if one of his guards are like, hey, Absalom's clearly got the upper hand. Let's slit David's throat and bring his head back to Absalom, and we get a promotion. Like, we're rich men. What if that happens? What if Absalom attacked the camp in the middle of the night? There's so many worries. There are so many what ifs that should have kept David anxious and awake all night. And yet he lies down in confidence because he knows that ultimately, even when everybody else is saying there's no salvation for him in God, God has said the salvation of the Lord belongs to the Lord and blessing for his people. And he lies down, he takes a nap, and guess what happens? He wakes back up. That's what he says. Verse 5, I lay down, I slept, I woke again. David went to sleep because he knew that the promise maker was also the promise keeper. He was also the promise keeper. And that's why he napped. So let me just ask you, what does your sleep say about you? Does it reveal dependence on the Lord who is actually in control? Or does it reveal self-reliance and you trying to solve your own problem and figure out how you're going to get through things or how you're going to be able to survive in the new year and all these things? Does it display a confidence in a God who keeps his promise, or is your anxiety so over-torqued that you can't slow down and sleep because God is in control? You can sleep and trust that the God who allows you to sleep is the same God who can wake you up. But let's take it just a step further, because there's a lot of what ifs, there's a lot of critical minds in here, and I'm one of those critical minds. Let's ask an awkward question. What if you don't wake up? What if you're right and you go to sleep and the atomic bomb does fall? You know, that happened to some Britoners, some Londoners. They went to bed that night in defiance. They're like, I'm not going to let Hitler into my bedroom. And they go to sleep, and a bomb fell on their head, and they died. Some people did that. There are some of you in here that will lie down praying, the Lord my soul to keep, right? You'll be praying this little lullaby prayer, and you won't wake up the next morning. The heart attack will come. The cancer might take you. War might happen. What then? What happens when you lie down to close your eyes knowing that God just might not open them the next morning? Who can sleep in a world like that? Well, David shows us that the faith that leads us to sleep every night is the same faith that leads us to courageously face death. It's the same faith. David didn't know how things were going to shake out. He had absolutely no clue what was going to happen. We give David too much credit of like he knew how. No, he didn't know if he was going to wake up or not from this little nap time. He just knew this, that comes sleep or slaughter, God is faithful. God would keep his promise either by preserving David's life or keeping his promise beyond David's life. David absolutely trusted that. And then there was a day that David actually did die. He woke up this moment, but there was another moment where he fell asleep and he didn't wake up. In 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 10, it's interesting how it describes David's death. It says, then David slept. It never says anything about him waking up. He died. He was buried. We know where his tomb is to this day. So why would 1 Kings chapter 2 describe David's death like a sleep? Because of David's faith, he knew that the same God that woke him up beside the Jordan is the same God that can wake him up from death. He knows it. He knew it. That was the faith he had. Faith leads us to close our eyes, whether it's for the final time or for the millionth time in a succession of sleeps to come. We can close our eyes by faith because of the confidence we have in God's promises. It might be your last night tonight. You might not see 2026. But you will see the face of God. You will raise again. Isn't that what he promised? You can close your eyes. I once read, it was a profound moment for me, that every time you sleep, you are rehearsing the same surrender that will require you to die in faith. Every time you sleep, think about the motion you make when you go to sleep. You lie down. You put your head on your pillow. I like to sleep with my arms up. My wife told me really quickly I'm not allowed to do that anymore because my hand gets in her face. And so she makes me sleep with my hands on my chest. It now makes me even closer to death. But I'm too afraid to sleep like this because if I sleep like this, I might actually die. So I sleep like this. And I lay down. I keep my hands to myself. And I close my eyes. And there's a very real vulnerability that takes over me. How much control or guarantee do I have that I'm going to wake up the next morning? Zero. I'm rehearsing every night the motion of death. I'm lying down and I'm going to sleep in faith because I'm vulnerable. I can't do anything about what's about to happen for the next 6 to 7 hours. I have absolutely no control over what's about to happen. And if I wake up, it will be because God decided it was still another day for me. And when I don't wake up, I can close my eyes in death and trust that the same God who wakes me up every morning and resurrects me every morning is the same God who can resurrect me from the dead. Not just can, but will. Because he promised. You see, like if we just had David, this would be bad news because David slept and then woke up and then he slept and he didn't wake up, right? So if we just had David as an example, bad news bears for us because there's eventually a moment that David slept and didn't rise again. But God is so good that he gave us a second David, David's son, Jesus Christ, to show us that even if you close your eyes in death, God can open your eyes again. He has that kind of power, and because he did it for Jesus, he does it for everyone who believes in Jesus. He makes the promise. 1 Corinthians 15, Romans chapter 6, Romans chapter 8, again and again and again and again. The same God who raised his son, Jesus Christ, from the dead after he died can raise you and will. Man, you know what that means? Go to sleep. He's got you. You're fine. You're fine. Take a nap. You know, there's some sermons that you don't have to list out a bunch of applications. This one's pretty self-evident, isn't it? Like, everybody go home and rest. You're planning out your year and you're like, goodness, the credit card bill is just exploded up, and oh my goodness, and we're about to lose the car, and if I don't make changes at my job, I might lose my, and you're planning, and you got goal setting, and all is great. Good job for you. Way to go. Plan to sleep. That is the best way that you can grow your faith in 2026, is to go to bed and close your eyes, knowing that there's a God who never sleeps nor slumbers and who's already proven his goodwill to raise you from the dead by raising his son, Jesus Christ. You can rest. Today is not meant to be a guilt trip for those of you that struggle to sleep. I know some of you have newborn babies. Some of you have husbands that snore. But what it is an invitation for you to address why you're so anxious that you can't sleep. Why the anxiety? Why can't you lay it at the feet of the Lord? I mean, it's one thing to not be able to sleep. It's another thing not to be able to sleep because we're afraid. We have a God who is for us, who has called us friend and allows us to call him Father, and who has made every promise become a yes and amen in Jesus Christ. You can sleep.